terrain, terrain. Pull up, pull up. Terrain, terrain. Pull up, pull up. Terrain, terrain. Pull up, pull up.
Declaration of War, November 25th, 1984. It is a dark and dismal time in the history of our race. An evil shadow has fallen across our once fair land. A certain vile, alien people have taken control of our country. When the day comes, we will not ask whether you swung to the right or whether you swung to the left. We will simply swing you by the neck. This is war.
The right-wing sect which declared war on the United States government in 1984 had many names. The Brüder Schweigen, German for Solid Brotherhood, the White American Bastion, and the Order. Former members revealed that a special order assassination squad plotted to kill the heads of three commercial television networks, former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, and television producer Norman Lear, among others. The unquestioned leader of the order was Bob Matthews, a well-liked lumberjack from upstate Washington. After more than a year of tracking Matthews, FBI agents surrounded him in an island hideout near Seattle. During a shootout on December 6, 1984, the house caught fire. When it was over, Matthews was dead. After the fire, FBI agents launched a nationwide manhunt for Matthews' followers.
In spite of Matthews' death and the arrests of his supporters, agitation persists for a militant, separate, Aryan nation. Order members say that the war has just begun.
Bob really one hell of a man. And imagine a man that would die for his beliefs. There's very few men like that today.
Bruce Carroll Pierce was the FBI's most wanted man until his arrest. He was also the order's second in command.
Just because Bob died or we've had some deaths in the past or had some setbacks, I don't believe by any means that the movement is over or that our goals will not be accomplished.
The order was a secret army striking out at a federal government that was vulnerable to armed attack.
The government's weak. The government is pathetically weak. This government is so weak right now that if 5,000 men of any race, of any consequence, any type of philosophical fundamentalism stood up, told the federal government that we have 5,000 men who would die right now, what we believe in, government can do nothing about it.
People are surprised at what's going on, and I think it's a situation you have to report. Guys like Matthews and others declared war on what they called the ZOG, the Zionist Occupational Government. When that happened, you saw the Fed begin to scramble.
It was the robbery of a Brinks truck in Ukiah, California in July 1984 when the order made off with $3.6 million that drew the FBI's full attention. At the same time, Secret Service agents caught several members trying to pass counterfeit bills. After his arrest, a friend became a government informant.
I believe that those men are prisoners of war, and I would support them as prisoners of war.
Tom Metzger is one of the most popular leaders on the ultra-right. While media attention was fixed on the trial of order members in Seattle, from his home and headquarters in Fallbrook, California, an hour's drive from San Diego, Metzger continued to recruit for his organization, War.
This is a time of rapid communication, and we must be on the cutting edge of technology like anyone else. We like it because it reaches into maybe every home in the United States where there's a computer. Every young person that is into computers, and there are millions across the United States, and they tend to be sharp kids with these computers in their bedroom, and they can log on and get all this information.
To attract others to his program, Metzger also set up 24-hour telephone hotlines in 8 cities, including Los Angeles, Sacramento, and San Francisco.
Why are the Jews and their supporters so afraid of free speech if they try to terrorize their critics into silence?
Metzger also has a television talk show aired on Community Access Cable Television.
Reason that show dedicated to free speech.
When FBI agents moved in on the order, members were within a few weeks of cracking Brink Central Vault here in San Francisco. With more than $30 million, they could have bought and outfitted an army.
I need my own state. I need my own nation. I need to have my own schools for my daughter, for my son, for my family.
When Nero tried to persecute the Christians in the Roman times, it did not eradicate them. and I do not believe it will eradicate us.
Just a few will be enough to reignite the spark for us to rise again. It's not over by any means. It's just the start.
We enjoin all people to choose intelligently which side they will be on. Make sure that you have the greatest number of relevant facts possible. There will surely come a day when fence sitting will be impossible. And once you have made up your mind and begin to act, the die is cast for you. There will be no turning back. With these things said, let the battle begin.
White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance calling. This is White Aryan Resistance. Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger speaking right here in the bunker, right here in north central Indiana on a beautiful, beautiful day. It's already about 50 degrees out there with full sunshine. I was out mulching up my yard again. How about that? Had all those leaves left over from last fall. So about this time of the year, I turn on the mulcher mower and mulch it in. Get that fertilizer down there so I can have green grass so I can go out and mow it again. Wait a minute. That sounds silly, don't it? Well, we're still at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where you send your donations. And, it's almost April 1st. How about that? Tomorrow, so play a prank on your local, well, I'm not going to tell you who. Yeah, did you hear that announcement I played at the beginning? That's the last thing that pilot heard when his plane was nosediving into the Alps over there. Yeah. That'd be a terrified sound if you didn't want it to happen, you know? But this guy was probably dancing around the cockpit. He was happy. Those poor people in the back, they had about, I think they said 8 to 11 minutes before the crash. Can you imagine that? You know you're gonna die, man. You're gonna die. And to have that much time to anguish, wow. Well, Yemen's the poorest country in Africa. Overpopulated, under the poverty line, rags, and they're bombing it. And the Saudi Arabians coming in there with all their expensive jets and stuff and bombing the poorest country in Africa. This civil war type thing, you know. It always seems to be in the poorest countries in the world is where the most vicious, violent wars go on. What is so sad or sickening is when they say they're taking a city. They're going to take a city. Well, you know what they have to do. You're going to take a city. You got artillery out there, and you're bombing the hell out of it for days with artillery. Destroy everything. And then you move in, and you've taken the city. But there's nothing left of the city, for Christ's sake. Oh, well, the insanity grows worse and worse and worse. And I have an idea that this Iran deal might just fall through the cracks, too. Today or tomorrow. And if it does, and this warmongering Congress and Senate of ours, they get their chance, they're going to say, oh yeah, let's go over and bomb Iran. Yeah. You know, most countries don't have the ability or the wherewithal to bomb back. But these warmongers run up against a country that can reverse the charges and bomb back, I think you're going to see a little different story. Bergdahl's the guy who walked away from his post over in Afghanistan, and if I don't know how many tours he did over there, but took a lot of guts to walk away from his post. But I support the guy. I wish all the military guys in the Middle East would walk away from their posts and go on strike, say, we want to go home, fuck this. But you see now what's going to happen, they're going to court-martial the poor bastard. I mean, with all the crimes committed by the high command of the military and the Pentagon, of killing hundreds of thousands and millions of people, they're going to land right on top of this one guy and make a show trial out of it, like they wanted to do with these whistleblowers. Yeah. You remember Lawrence Fishburne, movie actor? He got his start in Apocalypse Now. He played the crazy little nigger on the boat going up the river. That got on the machine gun and blew the hell out of that Vietnamese girl that was simply trying to reach in the basket to get her puppy. Well, he's been in a lot of movies since then, a lot of TV stuff, but his mother says now that she's broke and they're kicking her out of her apartment and on the street. And she hasn't heard from Lawrence at all. Good old Lawrence Fishburne. So much for black solidarity. Congratulations there, Lawrence. Oh, yeah, and the date is March the 31st, 2015, Tears Day. Tears Day, all day today. I suppose you see on the news all the hell's being raised because of this law that the Indiana legislature has passed about giving a back door to not doing business with homosexuals and any other of these people that the Christians don't like. I'm not getting involved in that, because as a Christian operated law, it's almost like Christian Sharia law that they're trying to get going here in the heartland, where you've got the fanatic Zionist Christians. Now, of course, all the right wingers are jumping on this thing. With the homosexuals, you've got to sell to them and everything else. Well, my position, you shouldn't have to sell to anybody. I mean, whoever you don't want to sell with, you don't have to sell, you know? That's me. But I'm not going to get involved in this mess, because it's a no-win situation. But it's interesting how fast the homosexual community can rally all these people and go totally nuts. I mean, you got to hand it to them. You watch it, the Ku Klux Klan and Hollywood Nazis and all those right-wingers are going to jump on this and jump on the side of this law to deny services to someone because they're homosexual. Well, number one, 99% of the public are not going to refuse, because they're so greedy that anybody that'll spend money with them, they'll take their money. I don't think there's half of 1% of the people or less than that are in business that would refuse money from an orangutan if it came in the door, or a gorilla, or whatever, because they're so interested in making money, they'll take it from anybody. So this is just a turmoil in a toilet is what it is. It's nothing that I'm going to get involved in, and I hope you don't waste your time on it. And don't, whatever you do, don't side with the goddamn fanatic Christians. You know, the news is so screwed up that I think we'd be better off just reading from the book here. Because the news is the same old crap every day. The same old crap. Bombing everybody. Negroes running wild. Mulattoes all over television and the movies. It's just insane. Let's look into our book here that I read from before, called The Cult of Equality. This was written back in about 1945, but it's an excellent book. And the other day I read you some information on the Negro. We're going to go back into the Negro today. Some recent writers, for instance, John Dollard in his book Caste and Class in a Southern Town, in discussing the characteristics of the Negro, have gone so far as to state that there is no such thing as a Negro odor, any more than there is an odor peculiar to Japanese or to Chinese. They say that filthy habits and the lack of the use of soap will always produce body odors that are, to say least, unpleasant. However, there is a distinctive odor which is peculiar to Negroes. Unfortunately, those with the diluted Negro blood or who are almost white do not have it. But among pure Negroes, it is observable. Thousands of Southern people who come in contact daily with Negroes know that this pungent, disagreeable odor is a racial feature that is not due to the lack of cleanliness, although non-use of soap may exaggerate it. The Encyclopedia Britannica edition 1937 asserts that the skin of the true Negro has a characteristic odor. Just why this is so, we do not know, but HOMA, John Hopkins, 1926, has made some study of this subject and has found that the Negro has three times more apocrine sweat glands than whites. The apocrines are the large sweat glands in the hair follicles of the armpits and the breasts and the genital regions. Schieferdecker thinks that the apocrines have a sexual significance. The odor, then, may be a secondary sexual characteristic. The voice. The voice of the Negro has not received much comment, but from observation it would seem that his voice is different than that of white people. There is a certain timbre about it that is peculiar and noticeable in chorus singing and in a female singer. The writer can detect this peculiarity in the well-trained voice of Marian Anderson. In his well-known paper on the subject of the peculiarities of the American Negro, Dr. Mottis wrote nearly 50 years ago, he listed many differences between Negroes and whites. Dr. Mottis concluded that there was no difference on the operating table, that surgically at least, the races were equal. However, there was an emotional and psychological difference noted in hospital cases. Dr. Mottis quotes Dr. Carson, who says Negroes in surgical operations, quote, that they reveal the apathy, the indifference, to make the struggle for life, which is such a strong psychothetical trait of the race, unquote. 200 years ago, Negroes had yaws and elephantiasis. These last afflictions still being common in the West Indies. The Negro was immune to malaria, yellow fever, and diphtheria. Today he does not have this particular disease, such as yaws, but his immunity to malaria and the diseases of the white man has also disappeared. However, many believe that the Negro is still as a race more susceptible to some diseases than are white people. For instance, tuberculosis seems to be the arch enemy of the race and latterly heart disease. Among Negroes today, tuberculosis progresses faster and is more fatal. It is claimed by some sociologists that their susceptibility to tuberculosis is not a result of racial deficiency, but caused by poverty, poor diet, and ignorance. Not all agree. Mavor, General Biology, Macmillan, 1941, says natural immunity is something a person is born with. For example, it is known that individuals of the white race are in general more resistant to tuberculosis than the Negro, while on the other hand, the Negro is more resistant to malaria than the white man, unquote. But it seems that the Negroes are particularly susceptible to diseases of the lungs, such as tuberculosis, pneumonia, and pleurisy. They are also decidedly affected by venereal diseases, and particularly syphilis, which is three times more fatal among them than among whites. Today, when the tendency is to maintain the theory that mulattoes show hybrid vigor instead of hybrid weakness, the opinion of the writer of 50 years ago may not seem pertinent. Nevertheless, the following observation by Dr. Matta is interesting. Quote, mulattoes, especially those of Anglo-Saxon crossing, have not the strength and endurance of either of the pure races. It is certain that they are more liable to hereditary diseases, especially tuberculosis and syphilis. Muscle system. There is not much difference between the muscular system of the Negroes and whites. Ernest Huber, who spent many years studying the subject, says that there is a difference in the facial muscles of whites and Negroes. The muscles around the mouth in the Negro are coarse, and in whites they are delicate construction. He points out that the faces of whites are more responsive, and that the mouth, there is a great range of varied expressions with many modulations. The mouth, even when closed, many serve as an admirable index of character. Huber does not believe that we can find equality, fine modulations of expression in the face of the Negro. He says the less differentiated, coarsely bundled mimetric muscular typical of the Negro and the greater thickness of the skin render this improbable. In fact, there is a marked difference in facial expression compared with the whites. Instead of a graded laugh typical of the white, we notice the characteristic grinning of the Negro. Thomas Batts and Denforth, in an examination of 1,201 whites and 318 Negroes, found that the pulsus longus, a muscle of the little functional importance in the forearm, was absent in 19.5 of the males and 29 1/7 in the female among whites. Among the Negroes, it was absent 2.5% for males and 7.6% for black females. As the muscle is almost vestigial, the fact that it is found frequently in Negroes would tend to prove that they are more primitive. There are many other differences in physical characteristics peculiar to Negroes. The spleen, liver, and kidneys weigh less. The pelvis is longer, narrower, and smaller. A small pelvis is characteristic of the great apes. The three facial openings of the orbits, nose, and mouth are larger, providing a better sight, a better sense of smell, and an intake of food in larger gulps. Generally, Negroes are slightly lower in height than whites. Their respiration is faster. The great toe is shorter. The three curves of the spine are less pronounced. The thorax is flatter from side to side. The papillary patterns of the fingers are different, common to African Negroes, particularly the Bushmen and the Hottentots, and not found elsewhere, is stereotypic. An accumulation of fat around the buttocks in Africa, the women have conical breasts instead of hemispherical as the white women. Cathartics do not act upon the bowels as with whites. It requires upon the average of 50% larger dose. The greater number of physical differences between the Negro and the Caucasian, the vestigial character of some and the possession of opposite characteristics point to the conclusion that the Negro is an arrested development in the evolutionary process. In his physical makeup, the Negro is undoubtedly nearer to the anthropoid apes. This similarity to the simians is more striking in the embryo, but is obvious in adult life. Recently, Ashley Montague wrote in a pamphlet. His real name was Israel Ehrenberg, incidentally. If some of our racists would take the trouble to visit their local zoo and for a moment drop their air of superiority and take a dispassionate look at either one of these apes, gorilla or chimpanzee, they would find the hair of the creatures is lank. Their lips are thin, their body is profusely covered with hair. In these characters, the white man stands nearer to the apes than does the Negro. Is the white man then, for this reason, to be judged inferior to the Negro? Surely not. Well, he was, Ashley Montague and Margaret Mead were two people that screwed up the thinking on race in this country. And Margaret Mead has been proven to have been totally screwed up on her studies of the Negroes in the islands where she studied them. But I asked, did you, when visiting the zoo, ever see a pure-blooded Negro looking at a great ape? If so, you would have noticed a resemblance between the two, regardless of the absence of hair in the former. So startling is the resemblance, in many instances, that it's in fact a vision demonstration of the theory of evolution. The features of the typical African Negro, low forehead, flat wide nose, and Pythagoras jaw, closely resemble those of the giant apes. And when I did this documentary with this Mo, this mulatto, so-called German woman, who they're feeding her all over Europe, what a wonderful woman that she was brave enough to interview people like me. It's crazy. And she's a mulatto. And I told her, I have to be honest with you, many Negroes have a definite appearance of the ape. And some of those people in Europe really went apeshit over that. Two opinions 100 years apart attest to the inferiority of Negroes. From Lawrence's Physiology, London, 1822, in all the particulars just enumerated, the Negro structure approximates unequivocally to that of a monkey. It not only differs from the Caucasian model, but is distinguished from it in two respects. The intellectual characters are reduced, the animal features enlarged and exaggerated. In the Encyclopedia Britannica, 11th edition, it found this statement. In certain of these characteristics, the Negro stands on a lower evolutionary plane than the white man, and is closely related to the highest anthropoids. The characteristics are length of arm, prognathism, a heavy, massive cranium with large zygomatic arches, flat nose depressed at the base, and the tendency of the frontal bones to fuse together and form an eminence of peculiar shape. But in respect to the character of the hair, the white man stands in close relation to the higher apes than does the Negro. Whether one agrees with these two conclusions or not, one must admit that the wide physical differences exist between the Negro and the Caucasian. These differences can most probably be resolved into the proposition that the white race has advanced farther evolutionarily and is therefore the superior race. Oh my God. Oh my God. I expect to have my door broken in and drug away at any moment. Mental differences between whites and Negroes. Until recently, racial intelligence was believed to vary in accordance with the color of the skin. Races were guided as to mental capacity from the white race, the lightest at the top, to the black race, the darkest at the bottom of the scale, although it seems to accord with the fact it is a thoroughly unscientific classification. Psychologists, however, have devised in recent years a method of measuring intelligence. They have now so refined and perfected their technique that while a test can measure only approximately the mental stature of an individual, the result is accurate enough to give a fairly good picture of his intellectual capacity. Attempts have been made to compare the intelligence of one race with another, particularly the Caucasian with the Negro. And over 30 important studies made in the United States, some of them based on a series that run into the thousands, are on record. Similar studies have not been made of Japanese, Chinese, Malaysians, Hindus, and Polynesians in their countries except in a limited way. In the United States, representatives of these last named races may be found in small numbers, and some of them have been tested, along with the native whites and Negroes. But generally speaking, there have been no intelligence tests, let us say, given the Chinese in China, with the intent to compare them with the test made of the French in France. The conclusions drawn from the intelligence testing in the United States have not gone unchallenged. Propagandists of the Negro race are now saying flatly that there is no difference between the mentality of a white person and a Negro, that is, on average. In other words, Negroes as a race are just as intelligent as white people. Such a proposition is based on a modification of the facts brought out in the test by introducing factors not considered by the tester. In such a matter, the result is made to appear different than what they are. Other plausible arguments are advanced, but to an unprejudiced mind, the extensive studies made of the intelligence of the Negro in the United States proves conclusively that Negroes are not the mental equals of white people. Again, we come to the definition of a term. What is intelligence? Does it consist of the ability to assimilate information, remember facts assimilated, and to rationalize about them? One might say be able to size up another psychologically and be quick to observe, but still not be capable of working out simple mathematical problems or mastering courses taught in the first year of high school. The Century Dictionary defines intelligence as 1. The quality of being intelligent, understanding, power of cognition. 2. Cultivating, understanding, acquiring knowledge, information stored in the mind. Webster's definition is endowed with intelligence or intellect. 2. Possessed of or exhibiting a high or fitting degree of intelligence or understanding, knowing, sensible. These definitions leave something to be desired. They do not say what intelligence is. It is defined in the terms of a few synonyms. A person may be potentially intelligent. He may be a man of parts with quick reactions, and yet he may have never learned very much or stored up much information. He may be mentally quick, but lacking in concentration. Another, slower in catching an idea, may retain it longer. Some cannot think subjectively and cannot generalize. And as with every activity in the exercise of intelligence, the determination to learn is important. The personal equation, the memory, the sensorium, seeing, hearing, feeling, tasting, all have a bearing on intelligence. For this reason, it is difficult to measure the intelligence of large groups of people, particularly with respect to the possibility of their acquiring knowledge. However, tests using a measuring intelligence show fairly accurately the mental acumen even of the individual who does not know how to read and write. The Army uses for literates the alpha test, and for those who cannot read, the beta test. Many intelligence tests have been made in the United States in the last 25 years. In all of these tests, Negroes invariably rate lower than whites. So regular is this showing of mental inferiority that Negroes and those who are pleading their cause have objected to the test as being inconclusive for the following reasons. 1. That the tests are conducted by white people. 2. That the tests are not suited to colored people. 3. That the tests are unfair to Negroes because their habits and culture are different. 4. That the tests employ aptitudes and tricks that do not fit the Negro abilities. 5. That the tests do not take into consideration the social and economic background of the subject. These objections have some merit, but we cannot declare that all the intelligence tests mean nothing and that the conclusions drawn from them are all wrong. It is claimed that a test conducted by a white person places a Negro subject at a disadvantage. He is ill at ease or nervous and feeling his inferiority. He does not do his best. But it may be said, isn't any examination given to white students an ordeal that most of them dislike? Unquote. A confident child or one that is afraid of himself because of his failure to study might be rattled and nervous too. Some people get excited over any kind of test, examination, or questioning. The argument that tests are not suited to colored people proves too much. If they haven't the intelligence to pass a white man's test, how can they claim to be his equal? Yeah. They say that most intelligence tests are not adapted to the aptitudes, habits, and cultures of the Negro. Likewise, assumes that Negro people are not used to the American way of life, which they claim to be part of. If their abilities are different, they can then be inferior. If intelligence is a matter of environment, then the last objection might be pertinent. But intelligence is inherited, else the chimpanzee living in the same surroundings as the African Negro would be just as smart. The apologists for the Negroes say that the reason for their poor showing in intelligence tests is a socioeconomic one. They point out that the cultural background of those making the low scores is below that of the white children making high scores. But is this the real cause of the Negroes' deficiency? Intelligence tests reveal that Jewish children rank high in mental capacity. Of 12 geniuses in Mrs. Hollingworth's study in New York City, 7 were Jews. In a study made by Terman of Bright Children in California, the Jews were 100% more numerous than the ratio of that race to the general population would allow. There was a great deficiency of Latin and Negro ancestry among the gifted children. Much has been said about the environments of colored people and how poverty and poor surroundings have affected their IQs. But is it not a fact that in New York there is a great deal of poverty among Jewish immigrants, and that the environment from a cultural outlook, to say the least, is discouraging? Yet this has not prevented East Side Jews from making good grades in school or from scoring high IQs. Furthermore, a poverty-stricken home is not necessarily one which inhibits the development of genius. In fact, many brilliant men have come from such surroundings. Poverty is sometimes an incentive that urges men to change their condition. It is a spur to their ambition. Children from the homes of the rich are not always the brightest and the cleverest. Well, some of them are idiots. In fact, it will probably be found that at most universities, the boys and girls who drop out of the freshman classes or who do not finish the course come from well-to-do families. Some of the biggest dullards are rich men's sons. Many of them, of course, do not care to study. They're lazy. No, the socioeconomic background cannot be blamed for all the faults of the Negro race, including its failure to rank higher in intelligence tests. The question of comparing the intelligence of one group to that of another is indeed difficult, since it is often hard to make such comparisons between individuals. For instance, how can one tell a good lawyer from a poor one? As many litigants have found to their sorrow, fine offices do not always make fine lawyers. Some obtain their business and their clients because of their personality and their social connections. The competence of various lawyers can be measured scientifically, and it is difficult to prove that one is better than the other. In one lawsuit, an indifferent or poorly trained lawyer may win over an efficient and brilliant opponent. But one swallow does not make a summer. And neither does one law case one make a good lawyer. For in no other profession can a man with ability, who works hard, be surer of rising to the top than that of law. A lawyer of ability wins most of his cases and soon has many clients and a good income. On the whole, the ablest and most competent law firms get the large accounts and handle the big cases. This applies to both the criminal and the civil lawyer. One cannot definitely prove the greater ability of one lawyer over another. Neither can one prove that one surgeon is more proficient or better than another. But nevertheless, there is a vast difference in the ability and mental capacity of individuals and the differences are evidenced by the results of their actions or lack of action. Likewise, differences in intelligence and in mental ability will be found among races, as these differences must be proved. Intelligence tests that fit the simple psychology of masses of people enable us to make comparisons. Here follow summaries of various intelligence tests and the opinions of psychologists, ethnologists, and scientists on the question of the mental superiority of the Caucasian. Now, there are pages and pages of tests and so forth, and short paragraphs on a tremendous number of people tested out, blacks and Negroes, and their findings were all the same. So I'm going to skip all those charts and figures and go to the next area. Mentally, the Negro is inferior to the white. The remark of F. Manetta, made after a long study of the Negro in America, may be taken generally true of the whole race. The Negro children were sharp, intelligent, and full of vivacity. But on approaching the adult period, a gradual change sets in. The intellect seems to become clouded, animation giving place to a sort of lethargy, briskness yielding to indolence. We must necessarily suppose that the development of the Negro and the white proceeds on different lines. While with the latter, volume of the brain grows with the expansion of the brain pan, in the former, the growth of the brain is on the contrary arrested by the premature closing of the cranial sutures and lateral pressures of the frontal bone. Over 30 extensive tests have been made by competent physiologists, and practically all of them show, first, that IQ of the Negro is on the average lower than that of the white people, and in grading the tests, the Negroes rank, when compared with other races, at or near the bottom of the scale. An IQ from 70 to 80 shows a borderline deficiency, sometimes dullness and sometimes feeble-mindedness. 80 to 90 evidences a dull mind, 90 to 110 is the normal or average intelligence. In testing 1,000 unselected children, the lowest 5% goes to 78. The lowest 15% goes to 88. The child testing about 85 is equaled or excelled by 90 out of every 100. The mean IQ of the American white children is 100. The IQ for Negro children between 80 and 85. An IQ of 120 to 140 signifies a very superior intelligence, and above 140, a genius or near genius. In spite of all the evidence that there is a mental difference between the races, particularly the Negroid and the Australoid, when compared to the lighter-skinned races, some psychologists and sociologists persist in asserting that there is no inherent difference. It is, they say, merely a matter of culture and environment. It is admitted that the white race as a group is mentally superior to the Negro, but the propagandists for the Negroes will not admit that this superiority is due to inherent racial factors. They assert that such differences are shown and they are due to the environment. If then it can be proved that heredity is more important in the mental makeup of an individual than his environment, their argument is invalid, and the inferiority of the Negro to the Caucasian cannot be gainsaid. I will not attempt to prove the greater importance of heredity when compared to environment. I will leave this to the biologists. Most biologists, however, lean towards heredity as the chief factor in the development of mental characteristics in the individual. There is, of course, the famous study of Galton. He looked up the families and antecedents of over 1,000 men eminent in the history of the world and concluded that genius and ability are a matter of heredity. On his list, by the way, not a single Negro is to be found, although he mentions Toussaint and La Ouverture as an able Negro. Well, yeah, there's a lot of able Negroes, but that doesn't make them superior or equal. H.S. Jennings, after stating that gene differences in individuals produce differences in mentality, writes, "It would be surprising if the same were not true for differing genes of different races. It might well be anticipated that the European whites and the African Bushmen would differ in mentality as they do in physical characteristics." Jennings admits that it's hard to prove differences, but he says both the genetic situation and the state of the present evidence then indicate that there are characteristic differences in mentality between diverse races. Herbert A. Carroll, in Genius in the Making, "It is observable and tested fact that certain racial and nationality groups in the United States produce a smaller number of intellectually gifted children than did certain other racial and nationality groups. For instance, one would be absolutely certain to find a higher percentage of children of superior mentality among those with a Scotch-Irish ancestry than among Negroes." Carroll states that there are wide differences in the mental capacity of different racial groups in the United States, and that while the causes of these differences are debatable, he believes that at present the evidence emphasizes the potency of heredity. W.E. Platt's In the Five Sisters, a study of the Dion quintuplets, writes, "The fundamental basis of intelligence is structural, and the degree of intelligence, however difficult it is to determine, is an inherited characteristic." Conclusion: the numerous records of intelligence tests, some of which are given in this chapter, all show that the white race tests higher than the Negro race. These results are explained away, as has been pointed out, by various theories, but their facts cannot be disputed. The unanimity of the results puts the onus of proving that they are wrong on those who believe that all races are equal in mentality. A few writers have boldly undertaken this impossible task by coloring the waters with psychological ink and by direct denials, which to some, because of their positiveness, carry the semblance of truth. They have succeeded in convincing themselves that intelligence tests mean nothing or prove nothing. Now, by wide publicity and shrewd propaganda, these writers are endeavoring to convince the world that their position is correct, and they pretty well won that battle. Today, it's all bullshit. Equality, this nonsense equality, is everywhere. Totally false. You cannot run a society or a civilization on falsehoods, and equality is the great falsehood. In spite of these denials and statements of several prominent biologists, psychologists, and anthropologists that there is no inherent difference in the mentality of racial groups, I think I have shown that there is a vast difference, at least between the white race and the black race, and that such difference has been proved beyond a reasonable doubt. First, there is a physical difference evidenced in the size of the skull and the weight of the brain. Generally speaking, the greater the size of the brain, the greater is the intelligence of an animal. The Negro has a smaller brain than the white man because his cranial vault is smaller. The frontal lobes of the brain are the seat of the higher mental faculties, such as memory and intelligence. The Negro's brain is full and low and receding, and the frontal lobes are not as well developed as the brain of the white man. Also, the sutures of the skull of the Negro closes earlier in life than do those of the white man. Thus, the brain stops expanding and cannot grow larger. Second, mental tests and intelligence tests of all kinds show that there are mental differences between white people and colored people. Tests, though more or less crude, prove the Negro is duller and has not the mental capacity of a white person. So there you go. That's my reading for today out of the book The Cult of Equality. And don't forget, discrimination is a dominant factor in evolution and natural selection. Without discrimination, evolution falls by the wayside, falls into de-evolution. And that's what we're doing now, full speed ahead, de-evolution. I have a book that was first written in 1888, and was by Charles Morris. I don't know whether you've ever heard of it, but it's the history of the Aryan race. I'll read two or three pages before we'll have to leave this. We've got about 10 minutes yet. It is our purpose briefly to outline the history of the Aryan race, that great noble family of mankind which has played so striking a part upon the stage of the world, to seek it in its primitive home, observe the unfoldment of its beliefs and institutions, follow it in its migrations, consider the features of its intellectual supremacy, and trace the steps by which it has gained the present high position among the races of mankind. The story of this people, despite the great interest which surrounds it, remains unwritten in any complete sense. There are many books, indeed, which deal with it fragmentarily. Some devote to its languages, others to its mythology, folklore, village communities, or to some other single aspect of its many-sided story. Yet no general treatment of the subject has been essayed, and the inquirer who wishes to learn what is known of this interesting people must painfully delve through scores of volumes to gain the desired information. Until within a recent period, the actual existence of such a race was not clearly recognized. A century ago, there was nothing to show that nearly all the nations of Europe and most prominent of those in southern Asia were first cousins, descended from a single ancestor, which not very remotely in the past inhabited a contracted locality in some region as yet unknown. Of late years, much has been learned of the conditions and mode of life of these people in their original home and of their migrations to the point where they enter the field of written history. From this point forward, the part played by Aryans in the history of mankind has been a highly important one, and there is no more interesting study than to follow this giant from the days of its childhood to those of its present imposing stature. Our knowledge of the conditions of the primitive Aryans is not due only to studies in philology. The subject has widened with progress of research, and now embraces questions of ethnology, archaeology, mythology, literature, social and political antiquities, and all the other branches of science which relate particularly to the development of mankind. Enough has been learned through the studies of these several directions to make desirable a general treatment of the subject and an effort to present as a whole the story that this mighty race, whose history is yet known to the world only in disconnected fragments. The present work, however, pretends to be no more than a preliminary handling of this extensive theme. A brief popular exposition which may serve to fill a gap in the realm of literature to satisfy the curiosity of the reading world until some abler hand shall grasp the subject and deal with it in a more exhaustive manner. Any attempt indeed to tell the story of the Aryan race, even in outline, during the recent age of mankind would be equivalent to an attempt to write the history of civilization, which is far from our purpose. But in the comparison of intellectual conditions and the products of several races of mankind, and in the consideration of the evolution of human institutions, the lines of thought and action, we have a field of research which is by no means exhausted, and with which the general world of readers is very little conversant. Our work will therefore be found to be largely comparative in treatment, the characteristics and conditions of the other leading races of mankind being considered, and contrasting with those of the Aryan, with the purpose not only of clarifying or clearly showing the general superiority of the latter, but also of pointing out the natural steps of evolution through which it emerged from the original savagery and attained to its present intellectual supremacy and advanced stage of enlightenment. As regards the sources of the information conveyed in the following The following pages we shall but say that all the statements concern questions of fact have been drawn from trustworthy authors, many of whom are quoted in the text, though it has not been deemed necessary to crowd the pages with citations of authorities. In respect to the theoretical views advanced, they are, as a rule, the author's own and must stand or fall on his merits, on their merits. Finally, it is hoped that the work may prove of interest and value to those who simply desire a general knowledge of the subject, and maybe in some measure serve as a guide to those more ardent students who prefer to continue the study by consultation of original authorities. Now, this book has 13 chapters, and it starts off with the types of mankind, the home of the Aryans, the Aryan outflow, the Aryans at home, and so forth. So I think we're going to go into this book, one of the many books we go into. And I hope I'm not boring people to death, but it seems to me that in lieu of all the bullshit that's going on and the absolute insanity that surrounds us, to delve all just on the news and stuff doesn't seem to be productive as far as I'm concerned. That doesn't mean that we're not going to talk about it, but it means that we're not going to waste all our time on it, because the empire, this Zog empire, has got to weaken, it's got to crumble before anything else can happen. And the conservative right wing and all these people, the progressives, who are not progressive at all, because you can't have their views on equality and things like that and be progressive. That's impossible. They can call themselves progressive all they want. And the conservatives, what do they got to conserve? Everything is leaving us right under our feet as we speak, and they're talking about conserving. Well, they're not conserving because they're using up all the environment, screwing it up. They're using up all the raw materials of the world to fight these wars and occupy other countries. So there's nothing conservative about conservatives. There's nothing progressive about progressives. Anyhow, that's it for today. I'll be back with you tomorrow, Wotan's Day. And think white, act white, be white. And remember, discrimination is the hallmark of evolution. Yes, sir, it is.
The church burned down 4 months earlier. No prince put out an APB on Friends of Christ. A week later, they were in Franklin. Revival ministry, old-time religion. You can imagine what Mr. Charisma thought of that.
Who do you think the average IQ of this group is, huh?
Can you see Texas up there on your high horse? What do you know about these people?
Just observation and deduction. See a propensity for obesity, poverty, a yen for fairy tales. Folks putting what few bucks they do have in the little wicker baskets being passed around. I think it's safe to say that nobody here is going to be splitting the atom, Marty.
You see that? Your fucking attitude. Not everybody wants to sit alone in an empty room beating off the murder manuals. Some folks enjoy community, the common good.
Yeah, but the common good's got to make up fairy tales, and it's not good for anybody.
Your sorrows pin you to this place. Oh, and there are a lot of good hearts out there. I'm looking out there. I'm seeing a lot of good hearts out there. I see a lot of joy out there.
I mean, can you imagine if people didn't believe what things they'd get up to?
Exact same thing they do now, just out in the open.
Bullshit. It'd be a fucking freak show of murder and debauchery, and you know it.
If the only thing keeping a person decent is the expectation of divine reward, then, brother, that person is a piece of shit. And I'd like to get as many of them out in the open. as possible.
I guess your judgment is infallible, piece of shit wise.
You think that notebook is a stone tablet?
What to say about life? You gotta get together. Tell yourself stories that violate every law of the universe. Just get through the goddamn day. What's that say about your reality, Marty?
When you get to talking like this, you sound panicked.
You think it's all a scam, huh?
Mm.
All them folks?
Mm-hmm.
They just wrong? Oh, yeah.
Been that way since one monkey looked at the sun and told the other monkey, he said, for you to give me your fucking share. People. So goddamn frail, they'd rather put a coin in a wishing well than buy dinner.
Jesus Christ, your arms open and closed. The echoes of my life can never contain to see the truth about you. You move the feather in the ash, you touch the leaf with its flame.
Transference of fear and self-loathing to an authoritarian vessel. It's catharsis. He absorbs their dread with his narrative. Because of this, he's effective in proportion to the amount of certainty he can project. Certain linguistic anthropologists think that religion is a language virus that rewrites pathways in the brain, dulls critical thinking.
Well, I don't use $10 words as much as you, but for a guy who sees no point in existence, you sure fret about it an awful lot. And you still sound panicked.
At least I'm not racing to a red light. So we all got what I call a life trap. His gene deep certainty that things will be different. That you'll move to another city and meet the people that'll be the friends for the rest of your life. That you'll fall in love and be fulfilled. Like in fulfillment. And closure. Where the fuck those two fucking empty jars to hold this shit storm. Like nothing's ever fulfilled. Until the very end. And closure. No, nothing is ever over.
Minister Terry, you recognize this girl?
I don't know for sure.